quote. Girard himself, I am not a linear logician. This is the inventor of linear logic. We'll just let that stand there. So we've seen linear logic as a syntactic system, right? We've seen the connectives and, we've heard some stuff about motivation, although in these few sessions that we have, we can't get very deep in terms of motivation. And we've seen the sequence system which basically showed that there were two flavors of connectives. There were multiplicative ones which would force you to form disjoint unions of contexts as you go along the proof. And there are the additive ones which basically inherit the context as it stands. Okay, we haven't seen the semantics. Slightly surprisingly, linear logic was originally semantically motivated. So it's actually the reason that Girard said this is that he and many other people saw and see linear logic as a tool in the study of the denotational semantics of other things, in particular the Lambda calculus, rather than as a logic in its own right, although it has since been used perfectly well as a logic in its own right due to its features of resource awareness that we see. That original semantics is basically, well, technically more than we can digest here. So it's a proof semantics where you interpret formulas as types, basically. It's a semantics that lives in the programs as proofs paradigms, so the formulas themselves become types, they're not evaluated to some truth value, but rather they are they give rise to a particular form of space, so they call so-called coherent space. So each one of these formulas, that means, gives rise to one coherent space, which is the denotation of the formula thought of as a type. And then you look at proofs of formulas, which are then functions between those types. So, like I said, this will go too far. So this is what one calls a proof semantics. So basically you give an actual semantics to the proofs in your system. That is something that we haven't so far done. We've given a semantics to formulas in our system. Basically we've said, well, we have a semantic structure and they're satisfied or not. Alternatively, we give them a proof value, a truth value somewhere. But the proofs were just there in the background. They established that a formula is provable, but after that we didn't care. So this semantics is different. It actually assigns a semantic object to a proof. And it will in particular allow you to tell that two proofs are essentially different because they denote different functions in the semantics. Okay, so we'll be slightly less ambitious here for reasons of time, basically. I mean, it's not that hard. I mean, it's not like the mathematical concepts behind this would be totally indigestible. I could actually tell you in a few minutes what a coherent space is. Actually telling you what a coherent space is probably faster than telling you the other thing that I'm going to do today, but the semantics itself then becomes more involved. So what we're going to do today is something that one could for the sake of distinction, refer to as provability semantics. So It's a semantics like the one that we've been used to so far. You discard the proofs and the semantics. You only care whether a formula is provable or not, no matter by which proof. And of course, this will be a provability semantics of linear logic, to be quite clear. And the semantics will be given in terms of phase spaces, which are algebraic structures. And the semantics is therefore more algebraic, so it's more like proof theoretics, and sorry, it's more like the classical semantics that we've seen in the beginning, the semantics of classical logic in terms of just a single algebra of truth values, in our particular case, just two truth values more generally. We could have assumed that we take a Boolean algebra of truth values, which would give us basically the same logic. And which we've done differently for modal logic and intuitionistic logic. For modal and intuitionistic logic, we had proper spatial structures in our semantics that you could draw on the blackboard. So of the semantic objects that I'm about to define, although they're called phase spaces, they're really more like algebras in the sense that you wouldn't really want to draw their structure. They're abstract algebraic objects. Okay, let's just quit the waffling. So what is a phase space? A phase space is a pair, M, orthogonal. I'm not going to read this bottom, but this is meant as orthogonal. So it shouldn't be confused with falsity. It has to do with forming orthogonal complements in the vector space, if you will. So this thing consists of two components. First of all, a commutative monoid, M. Whose components are right like this, as you hopefully... Who doesn't know what a monoid is? Okay, everybody knows what a monoid is. So a monoid has a binary connective and a neutral element for that binary connective. I'm going to write the binary connective as an infix dot or just omit it altogether, and I'm going to write the neutral element as E to avoid further overloading the one that we've already seen in a number of contexts. And secondly, a subset of the monoid. Nothing more required. And that subset is called the prole of the phase space. Well, that's all really. So on top of that, we're now going to stack a few definitions that will allow us to interpret our formulas. So first of all, we're going to want to introduce an orthogonality relation. So this relation here will be red. X and Y are orthogonal. Well, that is by definition going to be the case if and only if the product of X and Y is in this distinguished set. That I'm also going to read orthogonal. So if and only if x and y is in orthogonal, x times y is in orthogonal. So this orthogonality set is really just there to define this binary relation. And if we're given any subset of our monoid, we are going to want to define its orthogonal complement, and that's, as always, written with the orthogonal sign in superscript. And, well, it's not hard to guess what this is. This is the set of all y's such that for all x in my given set A, x is orthogonal to 1. So this is exactly like I would define the orthogonal complement of a subspace in the vector space, the set of all vectors that are orthogonal to everything in the subspace. Now, in this setting there, at one point the analogy will of course break down, and the first point where the analogy breaks down is, well, if I look at a vector space, I'm not terribly good at linear algebra anymore, but I don't believe I say anything very wrong if I claim that every subspace in a vector space, okay, let's restrict this to finite dimensional for the moment, is an orthogonal complement of its orthogonal complement. So every subset, every subspace of at least a finite dimensional vector space, I actually believe with every vector space, is of this form. And that, of course, is no longer true if you look at general nonsense like Lisztig, which has much less structure. So going to distinguish the sets that are of this form, and we're going to call them facts. So facts are sets that are the orthogonal complement of some set.
I'll try not to look at my notes too much, quite intentionally, because all this stuff is too confusing to be just copied from paper. Right. I wanted to continue with a very simple example, which is a corner case, basically. So a corner case that is so corner that many will tend to forget it. And that corner case is we could actually take the pole to be empty. So what happens when the pole is empty? How many facts do we get? Set is the orthogonal complement of what?
Any set.
Any set.
Is that true? Only if A itself is not empty, and so you get something different, right? If A is empty, set and empty?
Everything.
Right.
So we get exactly two facts. So we get classical logic, right? So we get a two-valued algebra of truth values if we make the pole empty. So classical logic is a corner case. Or the semantics, let's say, the standard semantics of classical logic in terms of just two truth values is a corner case of the space-based semantics. But I haven't shown that yet. I mean, this just sort of indicates it because I get two facts. So I would, of course, have to show that the definitions that I'm about to make will then
boil down to the classical definitions. I'm going to do that. Okay. Well, it's not so hard to guess that given this definition here, or at least given this notation with the orthogonal superscripted, I intend to use this, the orthogonal complement, as my semantics of negation. Of course, I still have to define the other operations. I'm going to define one auxiliary piece of notation, which is not directly going to interpret any of the connectives. Therefore, I intentionally write this by juxtaposition without any interceding symbol. I mean, the symbol one would instinctively put there is the dot, but according to Chernyshev's notational choice, is the dot is the multiplicative connective, right? So I don't want that confused here. So I'm intentionally writing nothing.
We can switch back to studying the movie.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm getting headaches all morning from two things: A, from these two variants of the notation, which are partly contradictory, and B, from the stacking of these many orthogonal symbols. The latter is the reason that I don't want to look at my notes, because I mean, counting orthogonal symbols in my notes isn't going to help me. I have to construct them on the board. Okay, so let's define this thing. This is meant to be just complex multiplication. So it's the set of all products, PQ, where... Oh, it's not XY. Where X is from A and Y is from B. And then I can define the semantics of my connectors. So I'll define the semantics of my connective, semantics of a formula. If I want to be clear, I'll write an index m there to emphasize which phase space I'm in currently. And this semantics is going to be a fact in m. So the semantics of every formula is going to be fact. Of course, given interpretations of the atomic propositions as facts. If these are really not facts, then of course they have no chance to get a fact in general. And this will work as follows. Now let's see if I can remember this. So I brief this to avoid getting lost. So first, multiplication, the multiplicative conjunction. Okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to take the semantics of phi, complex multiply it with the semantics of psi, and then, well, I hope to get a fact. Is this a fact? Sit down and prove that it's a fact. You're already sitting. Any success?
I'm still wondering if the way you wrote the multiplication of two subsets is really intentional.
Well, I like it too much somehow, right? So, somehow, I mean, there is a why here. somehow it went away. It really is just the AB usual. No. I mean, there's one can still sort of see it. I wonder why it disappeared. So, yeah, XY.
Okay,
yeah, just the way it is. Yeah,
okay.
Oh, next one. So what happens when one tries this?
Well, the idea I had was that that if I have two facts, and they are the complements of A and B, then that should be the same as the complement of A times B.
That is basically the question behind this, right? Does the orthogonal distribute over a complex product? Well, does it?
Well, it does if m times m is contained in m.
Bottom
times.
If the pole is closed under multiplication, then this would work, right? So we would have let's try this inclusion here, for instance, right? If we had x in A complement and y in B complement, and we have, we want to show that this is orthogonal to something in A times B, so let's say we have u in A and v in B. So we have to show that x, y, u, v is in the pole, right, bracketed this way, right? This is something to which we have to be orthogonal, and that is the something of which we have to show that it is orthogonal. And of course this here equals by commutativity x, u, y, v, which is in bottom-bottom, or pole times pole, but the pole times the pole is not necessarily contained in the pole. We're not assuming that. We really just want the pole to be any old subset of the monoid, not a submonoid or something like that. So this here, in general, is not contained in here. Okay. I just want to beat the guys who LaTeX this. I mean, go with LaTeX this. I don't object to that. So, that doesn't work. So apparently, I mean, I haven't shown that this is not a fact either. I've just shown that the proof that one attempts will somehow fail. And indeed, in general, this is not a fact. So what do we do to turn it into a fact? Well, we would turn it into a fact if we just added orthogonal complement once. But that evidently is not going to have the intended behavior. So if we mean these facts to become weaker as they grow in terms of set size, right? So the least this thing should be is monotonic in phi and psi. But if I write the orthogonal here, then I get something anti-monotonic, because the orthogonal itself is anti-monotonic, right? It's relatively clear that if A is contained in B, then, well, this inclusion holds. Well, it's so blatantly clear that we're actually asking you to prove it in the exercise sheet, right? So once that is believed, I mean, proved this here, it becomes clear that this expression here would be anti-monotonic in phi and psi, which is not the behavior we want for a conjunction, be it multiplicative or additive. So we just add a second orthogonal there. So then at least we get something that is monotonic by itself. The other thing that the sheet is asking you to prove is that this double orthogonal here is an increasing operation. So it will enlarge this set here. So the double orthogonal makes the old statement weaker. So in particular, which is implied by the non-fact, so to speak, that we get by just forming a complex multiplication. In some sense, it's a closure of the complex multiplication, the smallest fact that contains it. Okay, so that's multiplication. Still among the multiplicative, multiplicative connectives, well, slightly strange, the plus is a multiplicative connective, right? So, well, we know that everything's dual, so we now know how to write this, right? We just use the De Moore rule. So what do? We take the extension of phi, take the orthogonal, so I'm omitting the dots intentionally. Then I take the extension of psi, take the orthogonal, and then, well, what do? First, of course, I form this. I have to take double orthogonal of that. And then I have to put another orthogonal symbol here to keep get the dualization. So these two orthogonal signs still belong to the definition of the semantics of times. And this last one here is from the dual. So you color them, maybe, no, you can't color them. So. So these three that I've circled now, they're from the dualization. The other two are from the definition of semantics of multiplicative conjunction.
I would rather say the first of them is dualization and the remaining two are closures, but...
No, if you really take it seriously, then the outer one should be one from dualization, because you get... And what's dualization? You get orthogonal on the arguments directly, and you get it on the outside. In between, you have the definition of multiplication. Yeah. Okay, and... one of the things that you're asked to prove on the sheet is that this here reduces to just one orthogonal sign, so it becomes slightly less open. Okay, what's the other things?
Okay, those I'll have to look at because I don't remember. 1 and 0, right? So.
For one, we would normally want to take the unit element of the mod. Why? Well, I mean, apparently, I mean, one is supposed to be the neutral element of multiplicative conjunction, and we see that multiplicative conjunction is more or less the multiplication of the monoid up to the trouble that we had in making this effect again. So one should morally be interpreted as the neutral element of multiplication of the monoid. But again, this isn't in general a fact. Why is it not a fact? Well, we would have to find a subset of the monoid such that, wait a minute, so if we're looking for A such that A orthogonal is just E, what does that mean? It means that for all y in A, this is the case if and only if no So this, so the quantifier stops there, right? So this is the definition for X being in A orthogonal, and this should be the case if and only if X equals E. So can we see why this doesn't in general exist? So first of all, if we're looking for such an A, then the left-to-right implication here will tell us that this A will have to be a subset of the pole. Right? So this here implies, this equivalence here implies A is a subset of the pole. Okay, so if this is true for some subset of the pole, so we're looking for a subset of the pole such that the only element that will map this subset into the pole by right multiplication is going to be the neutral element. It's clear that this doesn't in general exist. For instance, while we're not insisting that the pole is a submonoid, we are of course perfectly free to take a submonoid as the pole. And then if we do take a submonoid as the pole, then for instance, this here would hold for any element of the pole, not just E. Right? So in general, we cannot expect. So it's just like this up, this is just a useless discussion. Is again, we just close this under double orthogonal. So this can be written slightly more shortly. The orthogonal of E. Well, something is orthogonal to E if and only if multiplying it with E takes it into the pole, but that's just saying that the element itself is in the pole. So this thing here under the second orthogonal is just the pole. Okay, and then of course zero, the interpretation of zero is just dual to that, so that's a triple orthogonal of E, basically, which, by what you're asked to prove on the sheet, is the same as single orthogonal of E, which, by what we've just discussed, is just the pole. So zero is interpreted by the pole. Okay, that was all in terms of the multiplicative connectives.
By the way, you can see here that the zero constant can be really chosen to be anything in linear logic. So if you think of negation as a suitable indication to bottom, then indication to a suitable zero, then you see that you intuitionistic, while intuitionistic negation has some like structure, and here it's really not that much.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Then let's do the additive guys. Okay, so let's start with conjunction, additive conjunction. Well, that one for once is easy. We just take it to be the intersection of the semantics of phi with that of psi. Well, of course, we have to check that this is a fact. Your turn. So, in this one case, it works as expected, basically. Well, for this junction, we now know how to calculate this, right? We know we have duality, also in this case, so we can just write this is... orthogonal of the semantics of phi intersect the orthogonal of the semantics of psi, and then the whole thing orthogonal. Well, by what we see there, nothing works. Okay. Never mind. This has nothing to do with what we see there. The question is this equal to the union of the two? Well, and it's not. The point is that, again, we have to take double orthogonal. That's right. Okay, that's the two binary connectors, and we have our neutral elements in the additive case. Again, those have to look up. So in the additive case, they are written true. They are written top and bottom for the lattice theoretic analogy. So top is indeed the top of the lattice. So the largest fact, which is M. Well, we have to check that M is a fact, right? But we've seen that M is the orthogonal complement of the empty set, so that's a fact, right? And then, of course, bottom is M orthogonal. And is there anything we can say about this? Yeah, so those are those elements in the monoid that, when multiplied with any other element, end up in the pole, but there's nothing more we can say about this. Right? So this can change. Okay. Okay, now I'm going to plow through the semantics just regardless, right? There's two things missing, and, well, there are maybe a tiny bit surprising. I'll have to define some tiny algebraic notion, which is that of idempotence. So, well, I'm actually not going to use that word very much because the equation that defines it is so much shorter than the word. So an element is idempotent if and only if it equals its own square. So, for instance, the idempotent elements of the ring of natural numbers are 0 and 1. Okay. And the set of these elements in our monoid is going to be denoted by capital I. And okay, and now the question is, for instance, interpret bang phi. Okay. Having already interpreted phi. So we interpret phi as resources, basically, right? So that's our intuition behind it. So bang phi is something of which we can take arbitrarily many copies, including none. Okay, so the idempotent elements of my monoid are those of which I get arbitrarily many copies, right? Because having one element is the same as having two, as we see here, right? It is the same as having three, is the same as having four, and so on, right? So being idempotent basically means having the capacity to spew out arbitrarily many copies of itself. So, we want those elements of the semantics of phi. So that's not quite it. An element that's idempotent will still insist on being itself at least once.
but the then will allow us to just throw the assumption away. So take zero copies of phi. So well, zero recall that the assumptions that I have, so where the bang set tells me I can copy them, they're on the left, on the left of our turnstile, so far. And the left of the turnstile is read conjunctively, as it has been so far, but conjunctively in the multiplicative sense. So having nothing on the left corresponds to the neutral element of the multiplicative conjunction. That's this one here, the one. So we intersect this with the semantics of the one. So these are basically those elements of phi that we can copy and throw away if we want. Well, again, the usual trouble arises. This isn't a fact. This is slightly surprising, maybe, because this is a fact and this is a fact, but this here is not. So that's why, again, we have to form the double orthogonal complement. Okay, and then about question mark, we can be lazy. This is just defined by taking two. Is there an order of precedence between orthogonal and bang? Allow me to know which one of these methods.
Maybe we should agree which one we use.
Oh, you've been using tilde. Or
just to try to be faithful to the first presentation. But I'm not sure if this is very used.
I think for the moment I would actually prefer the orthogonal. So
okay.
Orthogonal on the top means negation. So like this. We haven't so far defined the semantics of the orthogonal of a formula. Recall. Well, actually, it's cheating, though, right? We're going to say we form normal forms. Sorry?
Did we?
Well, I actually wanted the. And of course, I couldn't now just write. This, right? So, negation is orthocomplement. I was intending to do it differently. I was intending to just admit negation in negation normal form, that is only on the atoms, and because I have duals of all the operators, and actually I do want to do that, so I'll have to look up.
So what you mean by us defining it is that we did this De Morgan exercise last time?
Yes, and because I want to move to the single-sided calculus in a moment, I will actually have to do that, so bear with me while I look up the direct definition of the question mark, and of course I can probably guess it now. Here we are, so just a second. Well, it's not terribly informative. It's semantics of phi orthogonal
intersect I, intersect 1, and then, well, we add one more orthogonal to these two, and they collapse into one. So this. Okay, now it's a technicality, basically. Okay, so now we have defined everything directly, and now I can say this here holds only for atomic propositions. So I should state an explicit lemma that says is really a fact. I've proved this on the way, right? So the only place where we haven't explicitly ensured the factness of what we're defining by just inserting a double ortho complement, in that one place we have actually proved that what we get is a fact. Two places, right? The two places where we didn't have to insert ortho complement were additive conjunction and additive truth. And the next lemma. So that was why I took care to restrict it that way. The next lemma says that if I apply negation to a formula which is not a formula-forming operation, but which is now just inductively defined on formulas by pushing negation further and further inwards until it arrives at the atoms. This is just what we expect, so it's the ortho complement of the semantics of phi. And the proof is now just by induction on phi, and basically we've ensured along the way that we define everything in such a way that the duality laws hold. Actually, we've defined things by duality. Okay. Now, what's next? Right. So recall that we have linear implication. And it's the multiplicative part. Yeah, that's why it's called linear. So the linear implication is the adjoint of the multiplicative conjunction. And it's defined as phi bottom plus psi. What is the semantics of this if you simplify it?
Das kann man jetzt einfach umformen, machen wir mal und dann laden wir zusammen, dass das, was da rauskommt.
Was kann man
Yeah, that's well observed, right? So I haven't said this before, but it's clear from the fact that we can remove two orthogonals out of a triple orthogonal that if we apply double orthogonal to something that's the semantics of a formula, hence by the above lemma, a fact that we can omit that double orthogonal. So on formulas, basically, double orthogonal does nothing, which agrees with what we know from the syntax, namely that double negation is actually eliminable in linear logic. Okay, so what we have here is that expression on the right. So I'll just expand. So this is the set of all y. For all. So these are orthogonal to a product. So just take this product apart. For all y in the semantics of phi, and for all z that are orthogonal to the semantics of psi, x, y, z is in the Pope. Okay. Now, what does this mean? Looking at this y here, seeing this as a property of y, this says that for all things that are orthogonal to psi, x, y, z is in the pole, that is, this here says that y is in the orthogonal of something, namely, no, not y, but xy, xy is in the orthogonal of the orthogonal of psi. Taking into account that I have an implicit second universal quantifier of z here. Which is just the semantics of psi. So here we have an intuitively quite pleasing definition, right? So the semantics of the linear implication consists of all elements x that multiply the elements of phi into those of psi. So these are, in a rather concrete sense, functions from phi to psi, if you will, functions that act by multiplication. So they're very close to both our proofs as types, our propositions as types and proofs as formulas,
that proves this program's idea, according to which an inhabitant of a function type should really, or an inhabitant of an implication type should really be a function. Confusing the implication with the type of function. And it's also rather near this interpretation of intuitionistic logic that we've talked about, namely that a proof of the implication should be something that converts a proof of phi into a proof of psi. So that's exactly what happens here. Well, sort of, because these things aren't really proofs. We said in the beginning that proofs aren't really modeled in the system, but intuitively it looks somewhat like. Okay.
Has anybody complained that I'm not using the mic?
It's okay.
Is this switched on?
Yeah.
So now let's get back to the sequent calculus, and the whole object of this is to show that the sequent calculus is, well, sound and complete for something, as it were, for the semantics here. Now the sequent calculus can be simplified, and that's because of the orthogonal, or the linear negation. So basically, it allows us to equivalently push everything to the right of our implication sign in the sequent. Right. We have a sequent like that. Then this is completely equivalent to a sequent where everything is on the right. And gamma gets the orthogonal sign on all its elements. The question is only, can we phrase all the rules in such a way that we deal with everything only on the right? And there's, of course, one rule that would force us to move stuff to the left. If we had first-class negation, right, then we'd have a rule like this. If we have phi orthogonal on the right-hand side, then that rule would suddenly move this phi to the left, where we don't want it. But we don't have it, because I've just said that I want negation normal form. I don't want negation to appear at the top of a formula. The only place where negation cannot appear is in front of an atom. So the only rule that we need to deal with negation is one that deals with negation on atoms. Well, of course, we have that. That's just an atomic rule. So we're just going to change the atomic rule, the atomic axiom rule to deal with negation, which so far it hasn't. So far it was expecting an atom on the left and the same atom on the right.
And now we just modify this to allow for a negated atom to match a positive atom both on the right. So this is the only substantial change, right? So we have a new modified one-sided calculus where everything's to the right of our double arrow.
We discussed it last time, no?
Did you already do this?
I said that...
Have you given all the rules?
I think so, yes.
Okay, we've already done that. Okay, never mind. So, yeah, sorry, I should have looked at the notes.
Just to make it clear, last time this is what I meant. Right? I meant that you only have negation on atoms, and then the rules that I gave for the single-sided calculus are replaced with the two-sided calculus. Was that the last time, or...?
Yeah.
It even allowed us to stop this, to spot a mistake that I made in original formulation of two-sided calculus at the very end, thanks to the other hope. So.
Okay, so everybody happy with the fact that we already have the one-sided calculus? Very good. So, well, I'm going to write down the axiom rule anyway. Now it looks like this. So it deals only with negation on atoms and has both copies of the atom on the right-hand side, therefore one of them has a negation on it, a linear negation. Okay, now we want to establish soundness, in particular of this rule. We cannot quite yet do that because, well, we've given an extension of formulas in terms of facts, which are subsets of a monoid, but we haven't really yet said which facts we regard as true. So we write that M satisfies the formula phi, or actually a sequent gamma more generally, if and only if E is in the semantics of gamma, E being the neutral element of the monoid. So I'm writing the index here to be clear that this must have something to do with M, so just so the M appears on both sides, otherwise it looks slightly silly. Well, what is the semantics of a sequent, or which is now just a multi-set of formulas? Well, it's... Sorry? No, actually, it's... Don't confuse me. It's meant to be a sum, not product. No, I've brought everything to the right, not to the left. On the right, it's multiplicative, yes, but the multiplicative disjunction, which we write as plus. So I'll briefly write this as sum over gamma. Should be clear what that is, right? Okay, of course, still in there. Okay, so we now conduct the soundness proof. Okay, if we now conduct the soundness proof, well, basically we have to check all the rules and basically prove that they preserve satisfaction in the model. And for the only axiom, meaning rule with no premise, what we have to check is that this here is actually valid. So. So we have to show that M satisfies A, A orthogonal. So that is, and that is now where the headaches start, right? Because there's all these orthogonals all over the place. So this is actually a reasonably simple one, of course, so let's try what happens. I should let you do it. So show that this is good.
So what is this xi?
Xi? There's no xi.
Xi times gamma?
No, sigma. Capital sigma.
Sigma.
Sum over gamma.
Ah!
So this just means we read the comma as multiplicative disjunction. So
just for exactness, I would prefer what you wrote first, E is in, because now there's no longer any formula on the right, so it's instead of M satisfied, we could already just write E is in.
Okay, so that's the axiom rule taken care of. Okay. So the next thing. Would be something like the introduction rule for the multiplicative conjunction, which looks like this. So we have gamma comma phi, let's say, and psi comma delta, maybe, and we just multiply everything, basically. Well, not quite. So it's called multiplicative, but of course this here is rather multiplicative disjunction on the outside of these contexts, and in the middle we multiply. So what we see here is that we now need to know what a disjunction of more than two things is. We think we know, of course. So we think that if we have a disjunction, say, of three formulas, then its semantics is going to be what? Well, I'm going to calculate, of course, the semantics of all these formulas separately. Then I'm going to put orthogonals on all of them, form the complex multiplication, and then attach an orthogonal on the outside. So that's what I expect, because that's how the definition looked like for a disjunction of two things. But of course, it is now something I have to prove, and that's part of what I meant by the quotation in the beginning. I mean the edited one, of course. Yeah, that's the other part. So that's the one thing that gives you headaches, and the other thing that gives you headaches is the orthogonals that are going to pop up now when we try to prove this. So we're going to prove this as a lemma. Just for definiteness, I'm going to prove it in left bracketing. Of course, I would then have to prove it in right bracketing as well, but since everything is commutative, this law will apply the same one with the formulas bracketed the other way around. So, what do we have to prove? Well, let's first calculate what comes out as the extension here on the left, basically. I check if I need the single effects. Do I need the effects? No, I don't, because they're all immediately orthogonalized anyway. Okay, so what happens? I first calculate this here. I'm just immediately going to replace my formulas here by subsets of the monoid. I could assume that they're facts, but since they're all going to get an orthogonal sign on them immediately anyway, that doesn't matter. So here I've got one addition, right? A orthogonal, B orthogonal, and the whole thing orthogonal. And now comes the third guy. So that guy also gets his orthogonal sign. Here, I've got to put another orthogonal sign. This doesn't disappear, because this is not in general effect. And the whole thing gets an orthogonal sign on the outside. And I have to show that this equals the expression that I get here, right? A orthogonal, B orthogonal, C orthogonal, complex multiplied, and then in another orthogonal on the outside. So this is all I'm going to manage, well, if at all. Well, I am going to prove this now, and then after that we stop. Okay, what do we have to do? First of all, we have to prove implication from left to right. Not implication so much as inclusion. So we give ourselves a Q that lives on the left-hand side. Well, we have to show that it's on the right-hand side, meaning it's orthogonal to this complex product here. So I give myself three guys that live in these factors, multiply them, and show that E is orthogonal to the result. So I'm going to give them suggestive names to remember what they're orthogonal to. So I take PA and A orthogonal, PB and B orthogonal, and PC and C orthogonal. I'm going to write down what I have to show. I have to show that if I multiply everything up, that that's in the pole. Okay, now, to get that, this is how I started the proof, but it's actually even faster. Sorry. Wait a minute, is that the, yes. That is the easy part. That is the easy part, which I'm going to almost skip now. We will know from the sheet that by one of the exercises, what I have here, A bottom, B bottom, or A orthogonal, B orthogonal, is contained in this guy here. A orthogonal, B orthogonal, double orthogonal. And we also know that the orthogonal is anti-monotone. So that inclusion gets reversed, so it becomes that inclusion that we currently want. So the one we actually want to show, the one that is not completely trivial, is the other one. So the one from left to right. So this whole thing here can be removed. So we need a Q from the right-hand side. Okay, now we have to show that it's on the left-hand side. That it's on the left-hand side means it's orthogonal to this complex product here, so we have to give ourselves two guys that live in these particular factors here and multiply them and show that E brings this into the pole. So we need R in this guy here, A orthogonal, B orthogonal, the whole thing double orthogonal, and say V and C orthogonal. And what we have to show is that the whole thing multiplied up is in the pole, so you have to show that Q times RV is in the pole. Now we re-bracket this. And the trick is now, which one? I do have to look at my legs. That last one. So, this R is from an orthogonal. To show that something multiplied with R is in the pole, it suffices to show that it's in whatever R is orthogonal to. So it suffices that QV is in the thing that R is orthogonal to, which is still an orthogonal thing, just with one orthogonal less. Okay, now to show that something is in some orthogonal space, we have to take two guys from these factors here and then multiply everything up and show that it yields something in the pole. So we take one, say PA and A orthogonal, PB and B orthogonal, and we show that the overall product Q times PA times PB is in, not Q, but QV. QV times PA times PB is in the pole. And this should now be clear, allegedly. Why? Well, because Q is in this orthogonal thing here, we're multiplying it with V, which is from C orthogonal, with PA, which is from A orthogonal, and with PB, which is from B orthogonal. So this is okay since this product here with which we're multiplying Q is an A orthogonal times B orthogonal times C orthogonal to which Q has been assumed orthogonal. So this actually does work. And we can use it next time to do the requisite calculation to prove soundness of this. I'm not going to do the full soundness proof. I'll then proceed immediately to the completeness proof. The completeness proof will again give us cut-free completeness, so we get cut elimination. And for once, just because it's Christmas, I'm going to also show you a syntactic cut elimination proof. Just because in this, well, in a restricted system, not in the full lib system of linear logic, but in the first of all, the multiplicative fragment, and then maybe the multiplicative additive fragment. Because in that fragment, it's not so terribly hard, and one sees how these things work. Okay, so see you tomorrow.